In case you weren't here last week, I mentioned to the folks that were here that you'd be easy to find a seat this week. See, I didn't lie. I talked with Gwen, it was Tuesday, I think, and I said, I am really struggling with trying to figure out what to preach on. And she said, why? And I said, because the Seder meal, then Palm Sunday, and then Maundy Thursday, and then Easter, those were such meaningful, high moments, even for me. And so even the Maundy Thursday service, just being here and being a part of that, not having anything to do but give the benediction, it was just a powerful, powerful experience. And what was especially powerful is all, after each one of those services, all kinds of people contacted us, contacted me, contacted Lynn, contacted Carolyn, anybody who had anything to do with any of the services, Dawn, and just talked about how much they were moved by it. One person contacted me and said the Maundy Thursday service was the absolute best service he had ever been to in his whole life. I asked him how many times he'd been to church, and he said only one. No. But he just said it was that powerful for him to reflect and to hear the words and to hear the music and the scriptures being read. It was that powerful. I had another couple tell me that Easter was one of the best services they'd ever been to. And through the music, the prayers, all of it. And just the opportunity to just celebrate how what God has called us to do was having such a powerful impact on the lives of others. And so I'm thinking about, okay, Maundy, Thursday, Easter, now what do I do? You know, how do you top all that? I was just going to send out an email. Everybody stay home. Watch your favorite TV pastor and see you next week. But then it started to come together. Because after the resurrection, Jesus met with the disciples and on different occasions. And one of those occasions, he said, go forth and make disciples. Go forth and make disciples. It's pretty easy for us to say, okay, he was talking to the disciples. No. He was talking to each person that's here. If you are a believer in Christ, he is saying to you, go forth and make disciples. But the section of scripture that I love significantly, because I just love the story of Peter. I love the story of Peter denying Christ. I love the story of him sitting in the council of the wicked. I see him, cutting off Malchus's ear. I mean, I just love Peter. And then to see Peter at the end of John chapter 21, verses 7 through 17, we read, then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish you have just caught. So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153. But even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. None of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread, and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. The disciples are overwhelmed. Life has been turned upside down. They went from the fact that Jesus, their friend, their Lord, the Savior, was dead, crucified at the hands of the Roman authorities. Judas had betrayed them. Peter had denied knowing Jesus. The group was scared, confused, and overwhelmed. And then they heard about Jesus' resurrection. Mary showed up early in the third morning, and the tomb was empty. But what did it mean? Mary immediately ran and told Peter and John the tomb was empty. And the disciples came running as fast as they could. The tomb was indeed empty. Their hearts raced. Could it be? Jesus was risen from the dead. Talk about an emotional roller coaster in just 3 days, all that took place and how it impacted each of them. Then Jesus started turning up all over the place. He appeared to Mary in the garden. He shows up at the disciples in a room where they were hiding and the door was locked. And from the devastation of the cross to the emotional high of the empty tomb to Jesus' continued appearances, life as a disciple recently has been a roller coaster of events and emotions. Add to that, Peter wasn't too so high on himself after his failure in the courtyard during Jesus' trials. He probably felt that his ministry life was over. So what do you do when you're overwhelmed? When life gives you too much to handle? When you have failed at a crisis moment? Do you read a book? Do you check out? Do you cry or don't cry? Maybe you just hang out with people. Or maybe you avoid people at all costs and hang out by yourself. Maybe if you like motorcycles, you go for a motorcycle ride. But take a moment and reflect. What do you do when life seems overwhelming? Reflect on that question. Write it down. Well, Peter knew what he needed to do. I'm going fishing. He says, a few other disciples decided to go with him. Now, I'm not sure why they decided to go with him. One possibility is they remembered when Judas went off by himself. And they were saying, you know what? We're not going to let him go off by himself. Peter's not doing too well. We need to come by, walk with him, be by his side to make sure he doesn't do what Judas did. But regardless of the reason, there's nothing like a night out on the lake to calm the mind and soothe the spirit. When Jesus died and was buried, the disciples' hopes and expectations were buried with him. And when he emerged from the tomb, their dreams were left behind with his grave clothes, because the coming kingdom that they anticipated was not going to happen. It's not what they hoped. For them, it continued to remain shapeless, unfixed, and an unknown future. Now what? What are we going to do? How is God going to redeem these circumstances, these events? Because human nature cannot handle a shapeless, unfixed, and unknown future for very long. Just ask yourself, when you have an experience where you have an unknown future ahead of you, what does it do to you? And the scripture clearly defines, for without a vision, the people perish. Without a vision, without knowing what the future is, without a plan, the people perish. Vision gives us direction. One of the reasons it was easy for me to say yes to coming to Westminster is that both the PNC, and for those of you who don't know what a PNC is, it's the Pastor Nominating Committee. And they go out and they search and they research, and then they present somebody to be their pastor. And the PNC and the session had a vision for what they wanted the church to be and who they wanted to lead the church. They had a vision for growth. If they did not have a vision, I would not have accepted the position, because without a vision, people perish. Without a vision, churches perish. Without a vision, companies perish. It's true in every area of life. Without a vision, people perish. Without a vision for a marriage, marriages fail. And so there's in every area of our life, that vision is important. If I had heard the words from the session or from the PNC, whenever I, I'm going through the interview process, we have never done that before, that would have been the end of the conversation. Would have been the end of the conversation. Because nothing kills a vision as much as those words. We have never done that before. I would go to, somebody would be in counseling, marriage counseling, and I would suggest them doing something, and one or the other would say, well, we've never done that before. And I go, okay, and you will never do it again. And because of that, you will always end up where you currently are. And your marriage will continue to disintegrate. If you're willing to do something different, there's a chance of something different happening. But anyway, we've never done that before, but that is not what we do. Those two sentences kill all vision. They just destroy it. And those words were never said to me from the PNC or from the session. So that was one of the reasons it was easy for me to say yes. But when we cannot move forward, we cannot help but return to the familiar. Even a past we're unhappy with. I've seen couples whose lives are in total disarray. And because they can't go forward, they continue to go back to where they were. I've seen that in churches. When they can't go forward, they just go back to what they've always done. And what they've always done is what they will always get. And so they just slowly begin to die. So Peter says, I'm going fishing. Peter, ever the man of action, saw no future for himself in service to Christ, so he returned to what he knew best, his successful pre-Christ vocation, fishing. So Peter and his friends returned to the familiar. And so the Lord met them there. Notice, they weren't looking for Jesus. They were probably feeling sorry for themselves. They were probably saying, why do we even do this? We've wasted 3 years. Nothing is going to happen that we anticipated happening. So let's just go fishing. But Jesus came looking for them. He met them at their place of need. Jesus will do that with each and every follower of his. He will meet them at their place of need if we will allow Jesus to meet us instead of continuing to run from him. His grace and love show up wherever we are. He accepts and loves his own. Then in verse 7 through 8, then the disciple Jesus loved said to Peter, it's the Lord. When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his tunic, for he had stripped for work, jumped into the water, and headed to shore. The others stayed with the boat and pulled the loaded net to shore, for they were only about 100 yards from shore. As soon as Peter realized it was Jesus on the beach, Peter jumps in and swims to his Lord. The other disciples just rowed as quickly as they could to shore in order to get there and to be with Jesus. But there was no jumping in for the other ones. In this text, we see Peter's impulsive response to Jesus. His disregard for looking perfect or staying dry. And when Peter sees the Lord, he throws caution to the wind and dives in. You got to love that about Peter. But that's not the whole story. John is the first one to see Jesus. And so he points it out to Peter. He says, Peter, look it. It's Jesus. And there's a sense where John has this insight and ability to just see the surroundings around him and not just be impulsive, but to think this out, to say, okay, there's Jesus, And Peter, he doesn't even ask a question or do anything. He just jumps in. If we have faith like Peter, we care less about respectability, expectations, or consequences. We just don't care. This is what God tells me to do. This is what I'm going to do. When Peter sees the Lord, he throws caution to the wind. So when Peter sees Jesus, he doesn't care if he's going to get wet or what it looks like. So we've got Peter's approach to faith, the impulsive responder. And that's fine. That's important, but it's not the whole picture. Maybe John's cautious, but he's smart. At dawn, he sees a man a long way off, observes, continues to observe until he recognizes that it's Jesus. John's faith is one of recognition. John sees what others don't. And we need those kind of people who can see what others don't. Add to that, Peter wasn't so high on himself. Oh, excuse me. Going wrong way on the pages. This type of faith is essential too. Jumping in with both feet is great, but we need to know where we're jumping. Overabundance of caution is of no good, but neither is a complete lack of forethought. One of the documents that the session is working on is something called the VTO. And the VTO is a Vision Traction Organizer. And what it does, it helps the session is putting together what they see or what they believe they want Westminster to be like 3 years from now. What three years from now, what are the goals? And the session is doing that for the church. Staff is doing it for their own areas of ministry. Where do you see your ministry 3 years from now? Where do you see the church 3 years from now? And they're defining that. And it's important to define that, because once it's defined, the church has a vision. And we're aligned with reaching that vision. And it doesn't matter what's been done before, because it's the vision that's going to take us to the future, not anything that we did before. It might, but sometimes what we did before didn't work, but we continue to do it because it's comfortable. It continues to be comfortable, so we do the same thing over and over again. Another aspect the session is addressing is a facility master plan, which outlines what needs to be done to the facility that impacts our abilities to care for the sheep that Jesus tells us to care for. When these two documents are finished, and the session is working on them, when those two documents are finished, that's how I will direct my ministry here at Westminster, based on what the VTO says and based on what the facility master plan says. And those two things are important, because if we don't have those, then people cross into each other's lanes, they complain, they worry, they question, they do all kinds of things instead of just saying, wait, this fits. This fits with our vision. I don't have to worry about that because I know we're all moving in the same direction. When it comes down to it, each of our faith lives will be quite different. And our faith will change over time. At least I hope it does. It will continue to change with life experiences as we continue to mature in the faith to be lifelong growers, fully devoted followers of Christ. And the key is recognizing that in others and in ourselves to keep growing. Verses 9 through 11. When they got there, they found breakfast waiting for them, fish cooking over charcoal fire, and some bread. And I love verse 10. Not sure why it's there, but I love it. Jesus says, bring some of the fish you've just caught. Now the fish are already cooking, and Jesus says, bring some of the fish you just caught. And the only thing that makes any sense to me, and it's pure speculation, is that Jesus wants them to be valued and to know that whatever they've done is important. And so I said, come on, join me, and bring some of your fish so we can cook some of them too. So that they feel like they belong, that they feel like they're connected. And how many times do we need to do that with others that come into the church? Somebody says, well, what can I do to help? Oh, nothing, we don't need your help. Versus when anybody ever asks me, is there anything I can do? My first response is yes. Now, there's a reason for that. My father-in-law said I had the divine gift of laziness. So if I could find anybody to do anything for me, you're in. But there is a spiritual benefit to that because it allows every person to feel like they belong. And that's what every person needs. They need to feel like they belong. Verses 9, then in verse 11. So Simon Peter went aboard and dragged the net to the shore. There were 153 large fish, and yet the net hadn't torn. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen The Chosen. Anybody here seen The Chosen? Well, in Chosen, Matthew is seen as autistic. That's why there's 153 fish here, not just, you know, approximately 160, exactly. Anyway, another side note. Now come and have some breakfast, Jesus said. None of the disciples dared to ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Then Jesus served them the bread and the fish. This was the third time Jesus had appeared to his disciples since he had been raised from the dead. It's the third time he's appeared to the disciples, but in all the other times, there's no record of Jesus talking to Peter. So this is the first time we have a record of Jesus talking to Peter. John clarifies that the men knew that they were in the presence of the Lord, and his image of Jesus distributing the bread and fish is no accident. It is a clear example of Jesus' love and willingness to serve. So even here, in his resurrection state, he's going, let me serve you. Let me help you. Let me care for you. John notes again that this is the third time. But again, the first recorded message between Jesus and Peter. I can just imagine the stunned silence of the others who are observing what is taking place. You know, they're all sitting there, they're eating, and you know that conversation is going to take place, but you have no idea what it's going to be. And then after breakfast, Jesus asked Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And that's the first recorded words we have of Jesus after Peter denied him. Yes, Lord, Peter replied, you know I love you. Then feed my lambs, Jesus told him. Jesus repeated the question, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Yes, Lord, Peter said, you know I love you. Then take care of my sheep. Jesus said a third time, he asked him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt that Jesus asked the question a third time. He said, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Jesus said, then feed my sheep. The time had come for Jesus to address Peter's deepest hurts. Time had come for Jesus to address Peter's deepest hurts. Jesus will do that for each and every person. He will address our deepest hurts. Are we willing to allow him to address our deepest hurts? And when he talks to him, he's looking across the fire and addresses him by his given name, Simon, the son of John. Jesus uses the word agape here. It's not impetuous, but steady and deliberate. In Scripture, the transcendent agape love is the highest form of love, whereas philia describes affection. Agape speaks of loyalty. It is active, not self-seeking love. And so it's a love that says, what do you need? What do you need? And how can I help meet that need? It's the highest form of love, and it's active, not self-seeking. The New Testament writers drew upon this word to express the kind of love Jesus lived and taught. And it's the most difficult love to put into our life. It's very easy to say to somebody, I love you, with no commitment. I love you, but, you know, it's a brotherly love, and I'm there. It's emotional. It's caring. But when you say agape love, you're saying, I love you. What do you need? What do you need to grow to your full potential? What do you need to help you experience the fullness of God's grace, God's love, God's forgiveness? This Christ-like love emphasizes the importance of tangible expressions of service over emotions that achieve nothing. Many churches today do not focus on that. They don't focus on commitment. They don't focus on obedience. They don't focus on life transformation. They focus on having an emotional experience. And I will hear people all the time tell me, I love that church. I love the worship. I feel so good afterwards. And I will ask them, what aspect of transformation has taken place in your life since you've been there? Well, what do you mean? Well, how have you changed? Have you become more humble? Have you become more of a servant to others? Have you experienced the depth of Christ's love? Do you have a desire to go and share that love with others? Or is this just you go in every week and get your emotional high and then go home? And that's an important question for each and every one of us. Because Christ wants us to be transformed into fully developed followers of Jesus Christ, to be his disciples. And so it's not about emotion, it's about a tangible expression of Christ's love for us. So Jesus asked Simon, or Peter, about agape love. Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Do you agape me more than these? Yes, Lord, you know that I do. Tend to my lambs. What's interesting is that Jesus asked Peter agape, and Peter always responds with philia. So as you know, I love you. But he hasn't quite gotten to this point where, but I'm willing to do whatever you ask me to do because I might be still feeling a little bit guilty, or because, you know what, the way you've done it for the last few years isn't the way I would have done it. And so there may be just some of those questions that go on in his life. And then he says, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Shepherd my sheep. And so finally, with all the guilt and shame, a thing of the past, Peter was ready to depend upon the Lord to accomplish ministry. He was ready to put action to the words, I love you. So just as Jesus gently rescued Thomas from his questioning or his hopelessness, the Lord pulled Peter up from his guilt, shame, and despondency, and in essence said to him, okay, if you love me, get back to work. I called you to be a fisher of men. So get back to fishing men. Jesus isn't just saying that to Peter. He's saying that to every single follower of Jesus. Do you love me? Feed and tend and care for my sheep. Do we love Jesus? Do I love Jesus? Then my responsibility is to feed, tend, and care for God's flock, God's sheep. Unfortunately, personal failure usually leads to comparisons. We either find people who are worse than us to feel less inferior, or we allow shame and guilt to bury us at the bottom of the world, thinking no one is bad as I am. So, those are legitimate feelings, but they both come from an issue called pride. If I think I have sinned so much that God can't forgive me, I'm just saying I'm God. Because I'm bigger than God, because my sin is bigger than God. So if I can't find his forgiveness, I'm just saying God's not powerful enough to forgive me. And if I look for somebody who's worse than I am, so I can feel less inferior, it's the same thing. I don't want to feel as bad. I don't want to think of myself as bad. So instead, I will find people who are worse than I am. When I owned the bar, I was a drunk. I was a raging drunk. But I owned the bar, so I could afford it. And so I always found people who were worse than I am. People would say, "You're a drunk, Morgan." I go, "No, I'm not." There's people down on Halstead in Chicago that are drunks. I just like my booze. And so I always tried to find somebody who was worse than me. And that was strictly an issue of pride. But Peter emerged from his failure as a transformed man, one ready to acknowledge his own inabilities and ready to exchange self-confidence for Christ confidence. Peter was finally ready to accept the Lord's call. "You keep on following me, and as you do, keep on caring for my sheep." Have you failed in following Christ? His call to you is the same as it was to Peter. Just keep on following. Just keep on following. In closing, I have some thoughts when it comes to our calling. First, we need to take ourselves less seriously. Whenever you're in a discussion or an argument or you're voicing your opinion, ask yourself, what is important for you to win and what is important for you to surrender? One of the reasons I don't debate people, I used to love it. Our family grew up debating. But I don't debate anymore because debate is always a sign of pride for me. If I win, that's my pride. When I was in counseling, that's what the counselor told me. He says, "Your source of power is to always win, to always be right." And it was. It was a pride that was a barrier to mine and Gwen's relationship. And I had to let go of the need to be right. Now, according to Gwen, I still have a long way to go. But I'm trying to take myself less seriously and God more seriously. We must come to terms with God, who he is, and it is not us. While we should do our best and always pursue excellence, never forget that ultimately success is not up to us. Let go of pride and let God have his way. Peter was an expert in his career. He had years of experience and all the right equipment, yet his nets came up empty. Only with the Lord's help did the men find success. And it illustrated that without the Lord's help, our expertise and our diligence will come to nothing. It's when we surrender. One of the books the men will be reading will be, "When Did We Start Forgetting God?" When did we start forgetting God in our own lives and in life in general? Second, we need to be honest about our priorities. All believers are called as disciples, and all are commissioned to make disciples. So ask yourself, when you're worried about what's going on in another person's life, when you're worried about what's going on in the world around you, when you're worried about what's going on in the church, are you worried because we're not making disciples, or are we worried because we're not getting our way? Am I worried about not getting my way in our house, with my kids, with my wife? Or am I really worried about her continuing to grow in her relationship with Christ? Once again, when I started here, the session focused on those areas. They focused on making disciples. They focused on an unreasonable hospitality, although they didn't name it that, and being a generous resource to others. And they may not have named it that either, but those are three things that they focused on. We want to be a church that makes disciples. We want people to feel welcomed. We want them to experience that unreasonable hospitality, and we want to be a generous resource. We want to provide this building, this facility, our programs to others so that others can grow also. And all those things were being done when I started here. My father-in-law used to say, "There are no shortages of resources, just a shortage of vision to capture the hearts of people." When we have that kind of vision, we don't have to worry about resources. We're surrendering to God. God's in control. He will honor God-honoring decisions. For a season, I worked with the Leadership Training Group, an organization that went and visited churches for the purpose of consulting with them. And I traveled all over the country doing that. Then I was trained to be a church health consultant with the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, which was the church on the other side of town. And that's what I'm ordained as, an EPC church. And I think it's just, I think it flows better than ECO. But that's what I am. And I was trained as a church consultant. And I have worked with churches where lives were transformed. You'd see something happen, and people would come forth and say, "Oh, that was so exciting. That was so fulfilling." But yet, somebody would always say, "But they left the lights on." They were more concerned about a light than a life saved. They were more concerned about a light than they were about a transformed life. And there's something wrong in a heart when we're more concerned about that than we are concerned about another church. Another church that I was coaching, and it was dying. It was dying. And I asked, and they said, "We're going to have a fundraising campaign." I go, "Great. What are you going to raise money for?" And he goes, "For the endowment fund." I go, "So you're going to raise money for the endowment fund?" And they go, "Yes." "For what purpose?" "Well, so that we can stay in existence for another 5 years." "Well, what are you going to do when you stay in existence?" "Nothing but what you're currently doing." "Well, you're currently dying." "Well, yeah, and now we will be able to postpone that for a while." And so I thought, you know, you need to get rid of your pastor and your staff and everyone else and just hire a hospice director to help your church die. They didn't like that response, and a lot of times people don't ask me back. When Gwen and I, we got offered a position at a church in Rockford, and I was excited. And I was excited because somebody wanted me, you know. And it looked good. I saw potential. And we're driving home, and Gwen is being silent. She's being very polite. And then I said, "I think we should just say yes." And she says one word: "Session." Oh, yeah, now I remember. And it was a session that had no vision for the future, no willingness to change, no concern about people. And so I would have been the hospice pastor. And 10 years later, that church closed. And it closed. And I see that happen all the time. If we're going to continue to make disciples and we say we love Jesus, we need to figure out the best way to feed and tend his sheep. In the last couple of years, we've just heard some of the things that have happened in the last couple of years. In the last couple of years, we have repurposed the lower level. Now, if you've never been down to the lower level, you may not have known what it looked like before and what it currently looks like. But the fellowship hall has been all cleaned and floors. I mean, it just looks beautiful. And when we have events down there, it just is gorgeous. But all the rooms, there's now a craft room that is down there. There's a music room where we have jam sessions. There's a children's library. And then whenever a kid walks through the church and sees that children's library, the first thing they say is, "This is the best room in the church." Because it's user-friendly. It just provides that opportunity. We have done soup and studies, which had never been done before. Meet him at the cross. that Dawn did, Experiencing God that we're starting up in a couple of weeks, jam sessions. We will soon be instituting a thing called Administer Justice that will take about 5 volunteers, 4 hours a month to focus on helping people who need legal help to get answers, not to get a higher attorney, but to get help. Right down the street at Village Bible at the Grace Chapel, they're doing the same thing. And every Saturday, a different church provides space where that can be done and reach into the community. All of those things have been done. And a preschool. There'll be a preschool starting in the fall. 2 other churches are meeting here, reaching out to communities and people that we never would, that we don't naturally reach. A young adult ministry is being planned. Homeschool continues to use the gym. Westminster hosted the Eco Presbytery of the Harvest. Fit and Fun for 55, and we're going to be starting that again, right?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, wonderful. I say that. What? What'd you say?
See you there.
Yes, you will. Yes, you will. Prayer events. Everything you wanted to know about prayer. Getting real ministries just started. All of this has been done in the last couple of years. And that doesn't even include all the things that Buildings and Grounds has done to improve the facility to meet the needs of the people in there. And so all of that is being addressed and aligned with the Vision Traction Organizer. And we need to continue to do that for the years to come. And that's why this session is working on this and is also working on that. I am thankful that as a church, people have been faithful stewards of their time, talent, and finances to make all this possible. But I'm not sure if you know that Lynn and Dawn and Ken Perrin are only part-time. They only work 20 hours a week. Now, I don't know how many of you knew that, because if you're here, you will see them a lot around. But they're only supposed to be working 20 hours. So everything that has been done by people who are working part-time and volunteers who are coming alongside and saying, how can we help? Now, another thing, when we get used to something, it's just like in our homes. You get used to something and something doesn't happen. Our first question is, well, why isn't that done? Or who's doing that? So when I go home and I say, where's dinner? Gwen looks at me and says, at Chili's, let's go. You know. If I have an expectation that it's going to be done at home, then I'm going to always have frustrated expectation. But if I appreciate the work that she's done, and I appreciate all that she's doing, I say, absolutely, let's go to Chili's, because I know the work that you've put in today. So it's just an aspect of appreciation for the work that is being done, and to recognize that all of them are doing it in 20 hours. Now, that's what they get paid. If I called up Lynn, and it wouldn't matter where she was or what she was doing, or if I called up Dawn, and it wouldn't matter what she was doing or where she was, or if I called up Ken Perrin and said, I need you, every one of them would be there immediately. So they have that commitment and that loyalty. My goal, my responsibility, is to constantly say, thank you. The first job of a leader is to define reality. The second job of a leader is to say, thank you. Those are the 2 primary jobs of a leader. Those are the 2 primary jobs of a disciple maker. Thank you. How can I help? You know, what do you need? Define reality. That's okay, folks. These people deserve it, as do the volunteers that make it happen. Half of them are not here today. Third, we need to be honest about our imperfection and how God responds to it. While he wanted to put in the past and make the best of his lesser future, Jesus met Peter's failure head on. He didn't deny, minimize, rationalize, or ignore Peter's failure. Instead, the Lord said, in effect, "Yes, Peter, you blew it. And not only that, you're going to blow it again. And not after that, you're going to blow it again. You are going to continue to blow it. And every time you do, I can restore you. And every time I restore you, it's another opportunity for growth. And even though you fail, never forget your calling." And we all have different jobs and different responsibilities, which is a whole nother document that we've been working on. But everyone's purpose is to love and serve God's people and to make disciples. Failure is inevitable, and the Lord is never surprised when it happens. It is not though he calls us to follow him without knowing our future. When the penalty of our sin is paid in full, failure for the believer is merely a reminder to depend upon him more. To depend on him rather than self. To replace self-confidence with Christ's confidence. To let go of pride and embrace humility. By embracing Christ, we will embrace humility. One of the books that the men will be reading is a book called Humility by Andrew Murray. As I mentioned earlier in the text, we see Peter's impulsive response to Jesus, his disregard for looking perfect or trying to stay dry. Instead, when Peter sees the Lord, he throws caution to the wind and jumps in. If we have faith like Peter, we care less about respectability and expectations. When we see Jesus, we jump in, not caring if we get wet. So if we've got Peter's approach of faith, the impulsive responder, that's fine. That's important, but it's not the whole picture. There are times when I've been willing to jump in and my wife says, "Hold on. Let me show you where it's safe to jump before you go." You know, and so I rely on her ability to look at things differently than I do. It is John who sees Jesus first on the beach, but John doesn't jump in. He just tells Peter, who then jumps from the boat. Maybe John's cautious, but he's smart. His faith is important, but all we do has to be based on God's challenge to Peter. If you love me, care for my sheep, and go and make disciples. That's our marching orders from God.